So today I'm going to talk about the many worlds interpretation. So this goes back to Everett in 1957. So I guess we had the 50-year celebration of this in 2007, and there was a conference here at Perimeter, and you can find the lectures on PERSA if you're interested. There's also a big book that came out of that. I should begin with a disclaimer, which is that I would describe myself as an anti-advocate of this approach. But I'm going to do my best to present the case, the best case that there is for the approach. So here are the axioms of the Everett approach. The ontic state at time t is given by the wave function. The wave function evolves according to the Schrodinger equation. And that's it. So the claim, at least according to Everett interpretation that I'm going to present, is that you just need these two basic axioms. And the rest is just putting the right interpretation on this. So the claim is that these two axioms are sufficient to recover the appearances of the world, so tables, chairs, and so on, and also the empirical content of quantum theory, which has to do with probabilities. Okay, so there's a vast literature on the many worlds interpretation. Tremendous amount of debate on this approach. That's not quite what I wanted. And I'm certainly not an expert. Some of this research is very technical. So I'm going to follow David Wallace's approach. He's a philosopher in Oxford. Originally, he trained as a physicist, got a PhD in physics, then got a PhD in philosophy. Yeah, he's done some of the best technical work on this. So there are two problems that the two problems I alluded to here that David gives an answer to, or an attempted answer to. So first one is, where does the world structure come from? Since here we just have this big wave function, but many worlds suggest that you have some kind of world structure, where in each of those worlds you have tables and chairs and so on. And in what basis? What basis on this quantum state? And the approach that Wallace takes here is also strongly influenced by Simon Saunders. Who's also a philosopher in Oxford. There's really a sort of cell in Oxford of people working on the many worlds interpretation. The second issue is where does the Born rule come from? How do we get to the right probabilities? Where does the fact that the probabilities are given by the square of the amplitudes come from? And here, David Wallace took up an approach due to David Deutsch. Who is a physicist rather than a philosopher. Yeah, so David Deutsch is interesting. He, in many ways, was the originator of quantum computing. Certainly, he did the first substantial work in that area, setting up the theoretical framework. And he was influenced in that, or motivated in that, by the many worlds interpretation. He thought that you could perhaps harness the fact that you had this apparent computation in parallel to do faster computing than in the classical case. And so David Deutsch is also in Oxford. So the idea of this is you say, well, at the fundamental level, what we have is this wave function that's evolving, and that's it. So we can't account for these things at the fundamental level. So we need to account for them at the effective level, at a sort of macroscopic level. It tries to account for the emergence of what he calls quasi-classical worlds. And he uses decoherence arguments. And it's very important in his account that really this is just something which emerges at this sort of macroscopic level, that it's not part of the fundamental ontology. But nevertheless, its structure that you can see is there, and it gives you this world structure. So it should be part of our experience of the world. Okay. So let's look at an example. So imagine we have some quantum system. It comes in, and it's subject to in sequence to measurements. And each of these measurements, so A and B, can have one or two outcomes. Sorry, can have two outcomes labeled by one and two. So we start off with the system in some product state. Like so. These are the ready states of the of these devices. And now it evolves past the first device. And we can expand psi out in the eigenbasis of the operator associated with A, and then let it evolve past the measurement device, and so we get this. So this is the state immediately after this device. So next we're going to evolve this past the second measurement device, and I'll just write down what we are going to get. So we just do the same thing again. So here I'm just using the notation that A1 is equal to gamma a1 b1 plus delta a1 b2. It's a slightly strange notation. And similarly for a2, you'll have something is wrong here, isn't it? Gamma. No, that's right. Yeah, there's something wrong in this. I've missed out something here. A two, right? Yeah. B1, thank you. A2, B2. And then these coefficients are slightly wrong as well, aren't they? Because, are they right? So A1 goes to that, then A2. I'm going to expand it in terms of, I need two more coefficients here. Gamma. Yeah. I don't need more mu and u. So let's see. A1, that was right. And I think here I need mu and u. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're not the same measurement. Yeah. Anyway, the coefficients are not important for what I'm going to say. The main thing is going to be the sort of macroscopic states we have here. So we can kind of draw. You'll find if you watch David Wallace's lectures or look at his papers, he has these kinds of drawings. So coming in, we have a sort of macroscopic world, quasi-classical world, as he would call it, corresponding to A0, B0, then at the first measurement we get a splitting, just reading this off in the state over there, and we have A1, B0 over here, A2, B0, and then just continue these up a bit. And then we'll have over here A1, B1, A1, A2, B1. Is that right? No, A1, B2. A2, B1, and A2, B2. So it looks like we have this kind of branching in the wave function, but we could have chosen a different basis rather than choosing the basis in which we have A1 and B2 and so on. We could have chosen some superposition of those. Branching. So the idea is that, well, there's going to be all sorts of degrees of external, other degrees of freedom, environmental degrees of freedom. and they'll decohere in this particular basis. AI BJ basis. And I've given you the kind of arguments for that before, so I don't need to go through it again. So the argument, Wallace's argument, is that you have these branches, they're kind of emergent structure in the wave function. And approximate as well, her structure. Now, you might worry, well, surely we shouldn't have approximations in a fundamental theory. But the argument is, well, this is, we're just trying to give a discussion as to what happens at this emergent and approximate, emergent macroscopic level. The fundamental theory is still very well defined in this way. But at a macroscopic level, we get this approximate emergence of branches, and that's sufficient. There's another good framework which I called decoherent histories. Sometimes called consistent histories. Which is a very good mathematical framework for thinking about these sorts of histories, and which are good, which is a good basis to study the history. And this was developed independently of the many worlds approach, or separately from the many worlds approach, but it's very, you can apply this histories approach to this kind of argument. So that's the argument, is that basically you use decoherence to pick out this quasi-classical worlds at an effective, in an effective way. It's just approximate, but you don't worry about it being approximate because it's not the fundamental theory. You're not giving, so some attempts to make sense of the many worlds interpretation have added an extra axiom here, which said something like that you pick out your preferred basis in a certain way, okay, whereas this approach is not doing that. Are there any questions before I move on to probability? Okay, so.
I guess if you were to set up an experiment that was to try to, because this is just quantum mechanics, it's a mathematical formalism, there's no real way that you can test to see whether you get like a, whether or not you've chosen the right basis, like that looks weird, that question would be made a good, it's not really a good question for sake of experiments, so.
Right.
Is there any way you can rephrase that question?
I mean, you could imagine doing an experiment to see if you still had superposition at some macroscopic level. But that's kind of what was not the point here. The point here is that this argument is supposed to tell you that that you have this branching structure at an emergent level, and this is the structure with respect to which you would see the world. Suddenly, things like persistence of a memory, for example, would want to live in this world, whereas any attempt to store memories in funny superpositions would very quickly get squashed. So that kind of argument could be used here.
So what is the consistent histories interpretation?
There's the consistent histories approach, which is really a sort of set of rules for telling you when you can assign classical probabilities to histories. Okay, so you can say, well, I want to choose this set of histories and give classical probabilities, and it tells you when you can do that in a consistent way and when you can't. You have this certain mathematical expression that tells you when you can do that. But then there's also the attempt to turn that into an interpretation. And then you get differences between the different people who've advocated this. So one approach is to say, well, that any basis or any history, so history is a choice of bases, any set of histories. So where you choose a basis at each time, which is consistent, is a sensible way to talk about the world. Okay, and there's a big literature on that as well. Yeah.
It's possible this will take us too far afield, so if it does, feel free to defer it. But
right.
You know, one problem that a lot of people have with many worlds interpretation is this notion of branching. You know, like this, you know, we start with one world, and then there's two, and then there's four, and then there's eight, and just exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there's, you know, it seems like an alternate picture we could draw instead of this branching, where one turns into two, turns into four, would be to just have four lines going straight up that are distinct but indistinguishable.
Right, right.
Which, you know, has its own philosophical problems.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you know of anybody who's like studied this and that.
I mean, it sounds like that's the sort of de Broglie model in disguise. In some sense that you're attempting to, because then you would be on a particular trajectory, you just wouldn't know which one it was, so to speak. I'm sure people have, I can't pinpoint, I mean, other than that it's, you know, other than looking at the de Broglie model, I can't pinpoint, you know what, there are people who have looked at taking the de Broglie model, but then imagining you actually have all those trajectories. So then you don't know which trajectory you have, but they all exist, sort of like many worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just follow one. So there are models, and you everyone is, you know, you're on a particular, we're on a particular trajectory. We just don't know which one it is. So there is work like that. I can't give you the references, but people have looked at that.
A motivation for that is that this branching picture, you know, works great for spheres or whatever these are, where things take one of two alternatives. But for a position space wave function, you would have a continuous.
Well, the argument would be that at an effective level, we're only distinguishing a finite set of things, so you'd still get this sort of discrete type, this sort of clumping into different branches.
When you try and kind of like take this branching picture back down to the fundamental level.
But so Wattis is trying to avoid that. He's hoping not to. He's trying to say, well, this, you only need this branching picture at the effective level. You don't need it at the fundamental.
And if we were to like zoom in on this, it would get blurry, but that's the point.
That's the point, yeah, that you only need this at the effective level, so it doesn't matter that it's approximate. And it doesn't have is not really there at the fundamental level. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's his argument. I think it's a good argument. It definitely takes you into lots of philosophical questions that are more in the domain of philosophy than physics.
Is this undeterministic?
That's a good question. So fundamentally, it's completely deterministic because. You have this. On the other hand, if you live in this world, then you don't know what's going to, you know, what experience you're going to have. You don't know where you're going. So, yeah.
So you have both. Sort of the world as a whole is deterministic, but the paths within it.
Yeah, the experience you have, which is along a particular path, is indeterministic. So that brings us on to the next issue, which is probability. Probabilities in many worlds. So here's the problem. everything that has a non-zero amplitude certainly happens. So, for example, if you have something like this, and beta is equal to 10 to the minus 100, then nevertheless, this definitely happens. And furthermore, if you're in this branch, the world is just as real. Colors are just as bright. Let's see whatever examples. You're just as awake. You're not drowsy because you have a low amplitude in S. Drowsiness, of course, is a part of the state over here. Everything feels just as real, just as important as a world that has a big amplitude. Although in this situation, we would expect that the probability, we'd want to say in normal quantum theory, normally, that the probability for this is equal to 10 to the power minus 200, which is pretty small. But in many ways, it definitely happens. So why don't we just put the probability is equal to 1? Truly, that's the right answer. If something definitely happens, the probability should be 1. And even if we have a probability that's not 1, why not? Why not a half? Because we have two branches. Each of those branches is just as real, colors are just as bright, and so on as the other. So why not give them equal weight? Somehow it seems terribly unfair to say that the people in one branch are only half as, have this 10 to the minus 200 weight associated with them. What's the reason to give this probability? What's the reason not to give this probability? Any questions at this stage? Issue is clear. No.
I've seen this argument before, but it's never been convincing to me. I mean, mm-hmm. Sure that both of these worlds happen, but going back to the picture we have above, this is supposed to be a coarse graining. I mean, there's many possibilities
right.
within each of these possibilities. So,
right.
You know, if they're continuous, I can put some edge around it or something, but, you know, just pretend it's discrete for a second, but just more worlds, you know, more possible microstates that go into world A1. And in world A2, sure, it happens, but, you know, sometimes unlikely things happen. It'd be like, you know, however many trillions of copies of me. I got A1 just like I thought I would, and maybe a couple that are like, oh, wow, you know, look at that, I got A2.
But then if you had all those copies, then you'd like, you know, if I was sitting in A1 or A2, let's see, and you could like if my little space to the same dimension, which means I'd see an equal number of possible universes leading out from either one. So suddenly it's cross-grading.
Sorry, I'm not with you.
So like if I was in A2, I was in the second.
You make some admin, you observe it.
Yeah. Then you're saying that, like, there is less copies. But if there are less copies, surely there will be, like, less potential futures. But if you're sitting in A2, your universe still has the same dimension, which means there's just as many futures coming out there as there are.
I mean, I think it's true that the branching structure, it doesn't really see these amplitudes. That's just some structure because of the decoherence argument. Mm-hmm. And you can tune with the experiment the different branching structure. I don't know.
I think this is where it gets a little pseudo sciencey for me sometimes. But like you kind of have to figure out some way to you know relate what's going on in your Hilbert space to what you're observing and what you're seeing and you know how to follow like an individual. Person or observer consciousness through this branching structure.
Yeah.
Right. Because you know, I can sit here and say like, oh well, there's more copies of me going this way than that way, but we don't know what that means yet.
Right, yeah. And yeah. So I'm gonna give you the Wallace approach to this, which attempts to do something like what you're saying. Just one more point here is that we do get these very small numbers because if you perform an experiment over and over again, like you keep making measurements on qubits, well, the amplitude in front of getting all heads on a quantum coin gets very small. But nevertheless, it's just as real. So there's a question arises why, you know, you have this branch where you just keep getting heads over and over again, even though you thought you had a fair coin. The question is, well, why is that branch somehow unlikely, even though it definitely happens? In fact, I could even say, no, I want to put all my weight on that branch pretty much, and just have a tiny weight on the other branches. What's the argument for the sort of probabilities that you'd expect to get, the ones that come from quantum theory? Okay. So so this is the idea. So Wallace and Deutsch and other people have worked on this too. Doing here. Okay. The idea is to, in words, is to use decision theoretic ideas. So the probability is a measure of agents' subjective beliefs that they use when they make decisions in the world. So if we can think in decision theoretic terms, and we can show that in this branching structure, the natural weights to use for your probabilities are the ones that you get by squaring the amplitude, then we'd have a good argument. Probability is a measure of agents' subjective belief, and so it influences how agents act. This takes us into the domain of decision theory. And decision theory is a well-worked-out area of I guess, maths or philosophy. Quite independent of quantum theory, people have thought about decision theory. And there's various theorems and such like proven.
I don't understand that sentence.
Which sentence? Well, if you have a belief, so you're about to cross the road, and you have a belief that if you cross in front of an oncoming truck, you'll get killed, you have a high probability of getting killed, then you probably won't step out into the road. If you have a belief that you have a low probability of getting killed when you step out in front of a truck, you might do that. So, you know, the actions that we take depend on what we believe about what we believe will happen in the future. And this, all this story is happening at this effective sort of quasi-classical level. It's not really about the fundamental structure of the world.
But not everyone's a person, so
surely I'm talking about people or the kinds of systems that might use probabilities. And any system which is going to use a probability, so it could be a computer that's been programmed in such a way, any system that's going to use a probability will need some decision theory to help it use probability successfully. You still look worried, but
I have like rather than a cube, say I have like a large spin.
Yeah.
And I just consider the possibility of it being, say, the very lowest spin as opposed to the other possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see like how that's gonna be that falls into one of these kind of set. You're saying like why do you care about it? It's so better.
Right. I mean, I think your argument is that there's a lot of situations where there's no bets, but you're still calculating probabilities. I think you need this step. You need to say, well, the reason we have the reason we want probabilities is because the important thing that's happening here is that we're establishing that this effective realm concerning people and maybe computers and perhaps dogs who are doing something like this and using probability. And so all we have to do is account for this use of probability and to get the right probability, to get quantum theory, and then we're in a good situation. And we don't need to give a fundamental story. Probabilities don't have to be living at the fundamental level. They just have to, according to this point of view, they just have to be emergent. In some picture like this, like I said at the beginning, I'm doing my best to give a good presentation of the many worlds approach, even though I don't myself like it. So this is the point of view of Wallace et al. I mean, probability is a very problematic concept from a philosophical point of view. And so if you could find a way to say that probability doesn't appear in the fundamental ontology, it's somehow emergent, if you could actually derive probability without having it in the fundamental statement of your theory, then that would be a very good thing. I don't think they necessarily succeed here, but it's a good effort in that direction. And it's sort of interesting, even just from that point of view, even if you're not interested in the many worlds interpretation. Okay. So, here's how it goes. You have things like what they call in decision theory states. So state S, and these are really just the outcomes of the things that you might bet on. Then you have a bet. We have various bets, and you get rewards. And a bet is a function on the outcome, on the state. So for every outcome, this gives you a function. That's it's basically a reward function. So this could be the number of dollars that you get for each different outcome. So these people who set up decision theory, they impose certain principles of rationality. Let's see. E.g., here's an example. So this means that one would prefer bet one over bet two. And if you prefer bet one to bet two, and you prefer bet two to bet three, then you'd better prefer bet one to bet three. And so there are various principles of this sort. I won't give a full list. And if you have the right set of principles, then you can prove a theorem. And the theorem says, basically, that agents behave as if there were probabilities, or agents, rational agents should behave as if there were probabilities. So, in particular, so the theorem tells you that one, there exists a unique function, which is going to be our probability function. Such that if you sum you get one. And secondly, there exists a unique function up to affine transformations. This is the function mu, which is on bets, which is such that B1 is greater than B2 if and only if So incidentally, you can think of this function as being a kind of utility function. It's a sort of reward. This is the reward for the different for the outcomes of the bets. What am I doing? Okay. So you're taking the weighted reward you get for bet one and the weighted reward you get for bet two. And it seems reasonable that you would prefer bet one if you get a bigger reward on average than bet two. And so these principles of rationality give you the existence of this probability function and this fact that there exists this this function. So the main point is that it's telling you that agents that believe in this set of principles will behave as if there were probabilities. And so what David Wallace does is he leverages this within the many worlds context. So we want to show that these probabilities should be the amplitude squared. Okay. So there's this principle in philosophy called the principle. Philosophy is full of these colorful kinds of names for things. So here's the idea. So we imagine that there's some objective probability and there's some subjective probability. So an agent who knows that the objective probability for something happening is P, a rational agent who knows that the objective probability for something happening is P, is required Because he's rational, according to this principle. Is required to choose this as his subjective probability. So if you were, if you knew that the objective probability for being killed when you were hit by a truck was, you know, 0.9999 or something, and you are a rational agent, then you'll use that as your subjective probability when you make the decision as to whether to step in front of it or not.
Is that just kind of defining what a rational agent is?
I guess it's saying that they can't feel lucky. Right? Like,
maybe, yeah. But it's also making some assertion about the role of these objective probabilities in decision theory. Yeah. So I'm not a philosopher, and I can't really tell you much about the history of this. Okay. Well, I should probably stop there. Well, I'll just quickly tell you what. I'm not going to discuss any of the details of Wallace's proof. But what he has is he has a set of axioms. Which he thinks are reasonable for this sort of for an agent, sort of in this world making decisions. So these axioms apply decision theoretic ideas to the branching structure. And then he gives a proof that that your objective probability is now given by alpha squared. So how does the proof work? It has sort of two parts to it. First of all, he proves that if two events have the same weight, the same amplitude, same amplitude squared, because we don't care about the phase, then it follows from this set of axioms that agents are required rationally to give them the same probabilities. Rational agents. Irrational agents can do whatever they want. And then B, and he calls this the equivalence rule. So if you have the same alpha squared, the same probabilities, then he uses the equivalence rule to prove Born's rule. And that's it. Okay. Well, I've gone slightly over time. Tomorrow I'll go through some criticisms of the many worlds approach, and then I'll move on to the collapse models.